My name is Giles, and I do work at University of Cambridge. I sound weird because my wife's English, but I've been here for 25 years. I'm originally from San Francisco. I did my undergrad at University of California at Berkeley. I'm a geneticist by trade. I think it's a perfectly upstanding thing to do. Last time I checked, my mother-in-law, who is from this fair city, still speaks to me. So this is all good things for domestic bliss, which is hard won. I just want to point out. But what's interesting is when people ask what disease I study, or what trait, disease, okay, I study, and I say obesity. Actually, I say body weight, of which obesity is on one end of the spectrum. It is still body weight. Immediately, I become the bad person. And I become the bad person because I'm perceived as giving fat people, overweight people, people with obesity, an excuse. Which philosophically, I always find a very interesting take on it. Because if I was studying the genetics of dementia, the genetics of cancer, the genetics of rheumatoid arthritis, would I suddenly be giving those people suffering from those problems, those diseases, those issues, an excuse? I'd like to think not. I'd be trying to understand biological pathways. I'd be trying to help them, okay? But yet, when one is talking about body weight, suddenly I'm giving people an excuse. So I want you to take the next, 45 minutes or so as a rebuttal as to why I don't think it is excuse at all. And why I don't think, and you know, once again, you can disagree with me once I'm done, why I don't think body weight and hence obesity is actually a choice at all, right? So, and this is the reason why I'm a bad person, okay? Or I'm considered a bad person. I think we all have seen gazillion versions of this scales of justice, right? This energy balance equation. It's otherwise known as the first law of thermodynamics. Okay, for those of you who remember your physics, you can't magic conservation of energy. You can't magic energy from anywhere. You can't magic the energy away, the calories away. So the only way, ladies and gentlemen, that you can actually gain weight is to eat more than you burn, and hence, ergo, the only way to lose weight is to burn more than you eat. You guys are thinking, eat less and move more. Are you serious? This is what we're here to take notes about. But that's because it's true, and it's true because it's physics. Okay, it's the fundamental law, and you can't bypass that law. But, and this is the big but here, that is the how. Okay, yes, fine. How one has got to this particular body weight, or you, or what have you, is going to be a function of physics by its very definition. I think the more interesting question, the more complex question to ask is why. Okay, in particular, why do people behave so very differently around food? Okay, and in terms of our feeding behavior, let me set up a scenario for you. This is what I call the Monday morning meeting scenario. Okay, and so you're here. It's Monday morning meeting. You sat around the table, and someone inconsiderately slides a plate of cookies across the table. All right. So now I'm going to argue, as the plate of cookies are sliding, that there are four different behaviors to this plate of cookies. Okay. So the first behavior, me. Okay. I've got a cookie in my hand before the plate stops sliding. Okay, and I go munch. We know who we are here. The second behavior, and this is an interesting one, are the people who long for the cookie. They would love to have the cookie, all right? And they fixate upon the cookie, but for whatever internal algorithm, does not pick up the cookie, all right? But focuses so much on the cookie, ignores the rest of the meeting. The third person is the most annoying person. Behavior, okay, person, I don't want to personalize it, the most annoying behavior, and these are people who don't even know the cookies have arrived. They're going, what cookie, right? And then number four, the people who eat the cookie without even knowing they've had the cookie, all right? And once again, it's slightly ha-ha, but not that ha-ha, because I think all of us, I'd like to think, can point either ourselves or someone we know to one of those four behaviors. Inbuilt into that scenario is the fact that we're all at the same meeting. Okay, so pretty much we're probably of the same socioeconomic class. We're probably at the same educational level, okay, whatever level that might be. But yet, these behaviors are still there. So here's the question, is it choice? Is it actually moral fiber, okay, for one person not to know the cookies have arrived, and for someone to really want the cookie, or for someone else to actually eat the cookie without knowing they've eaten the cookie? Okay. And I would argue that, yeah, okay, clearly there's a lot of complex layering to put in there. But I want to argue that inbuilt into those differences in behaviors are actually a lot of biological complexity that is there and that we're interested in studying. Obesity is a big problem. I don't want to bang on about this. I think we all have seen versions of this once again. This particular one comes from Nature in 2014 about the issue of obesity as an epidemic, pandemic. Are these accurate words? I don't know, but it's certainly a problem. Clearly, the problems within in North America, within Western Europe, and where we live here, well rehearsed, all right? So I'm not going to bang on about that. The reason I've showed you this graph is because this figure is because I just want to point out we're nowhere near the maximum of the problem, which might be an odd thing to say given everything we hear about it. And it's because of this little tiny corner of the world over here, okay? The Indian subcontinent and China. Now, yes, there are probably 300 million mainland Chinese with the expendable income to travel abroad where we travel abroad so that you can, these are the folks we meet on vacation or what have you over here, right? There are probably a similar number of South Asian Indians, 300 million, okay, doing exactly the same thing. But don't forget, there are 1 billion Indians, Pakistani, South Asians, stuck out in the sticks, and another 1.1 billion probably Chinese stuck out in the sticks as well, where when they are in poverty, there is not enough food, so they're skinny. Okay, which is a different scenario where we are now, where there is this uncomfortable link between socioeconomic class and increased risk of obesity. Now, as these respective governments are now trying to drag their people out of poverty, whatever word you want to use, suddenly an extra 2 billion people in the world are exposed to the same environment we are exposed to. We will then reach the maximum of the problem. And I'd like to think we should be able to try and make some headway into trying to tackle the issue before it becomes a full-blown problem. Not that it isn't already. I love this graph, okay? Or, you know, it's like a nerd 6D type of thing. The data comes from the U.S. Center for Disease Control. If you search Google U.S. obesity map CDC, you'll find it. The GIF comes from the Washington Post, all right? And so what this is doing is you can see a moving time from 84, the so-called ground zero from when we began to realize that obesity was beginning to become a problem. And it is graphing the histogram of BMI, which is imperfect, I realize. But nonetheless, let's take as read for this particular graph that between 20 and 25 is normal. 25 to 30 is overweight and above 30 is obese, all right? So what you see here is in a male, and the same is going to be true for females. When a male in 1984, boom. What you see is that the average BMI of a male in 1984 would be 22 to 23, okay? Normal. Whereas look what happens in 2014, which is where this data ends, okay? 27, 28. We have become overweight as normal, and the numbers are same for females. So the question, as a geneticist, is, well, has this change happened because of our genes? Okay, and the answer clearly is going to be no. And the reason why it's no is because between 84 and 2014, I think the vast majority of you were not alive in 84, but that's fine. Okay, but I certainly, and then Stanley, was alive throughout the entire process, but you folks would have been alive throughout the vast majority of this process. And our genes have not changed. Okay, certainly not by any appreciable fashion. So really, the reason why we've become larger, okay, as a species, is because of a change in environment. Okay, so that is going to be true. But if it was only the environment that played a role, okay, with no biological variation at all, in other words, we responded the same way to the environment, then in theory, you should see that the 1984 histogram shifts in its entirety upwards, because everyone behaves the same way in the same environment. You're just eating too much, you become too fat, okay? So you should end up with a shape that kind of looks like a Golden Gate Bridge. But that's not what you see. What you see is you see a change in shape of the histogram. And if all the data points, the human beings, okay, alive in 84, is still alive today in 2014, and that's a safe assumption to make, then the only way you change the shape of a histogram upon some kind of environmental perturbation is if everybody responds differently to exactly the same environmental change. So we stay within the field. Why have we gotten larger? Because we don't eat. Because we eat too much and don't move enough. Okay. But where do we sit on a normal distribution? Do we gain any weight? How much weight do we gain? Do we lose weight within this scenario? That is powerfully biologically influenced. And when we talk about biology, look, we've got to talk about genes. Clearly. And a lot of the determining of the genetics of human traits have come from twin studies. Now, that come from other studies as well, but particularly from twin studies. I'm sure many of you understand what twin studies are, but I'll briefly praise it so that we're on a kind of the same level. They're going to be identical twins who share 100% of genetic material, obviously, and they're going to be fraternal twins, non-identical twins, who share as much genetic material as you would with your own siblings, or for that matter, your folks, okay, 50%. So you could take any given human trait and ask the question, if I share all my genes versus if I share 50% of my genes, and measure what we call the heritability. Now, the heritability is the percentage of the variation of a given trait, any given trait, that is going to be down to your genes, as opposed to your non-genes, the environment, okay, broadly speaking. So I'll give you a couple of examples. If I had hair, my hair would be black. And now hair color is going to be clearly have a powerful genetic influence, of course, but with very little environmental impact. Peroxide does not count, okay, as an environmental impact. Now let's look at another trait, freckles, okay? Now freckles are clearly going to have a genetic input, clearly, but yet, how many appear? Do they appear at all? Even amongst identical twins would entirely depend on whether or not I wear t-shirts. Do I like to stand in the sun? Okay, so there we have a powerful genetic trait which has an equally powerful environmental influence. Now, as it turns out, every single human trait and behavior, every single human trait and behavior will have a genetic influence. The trick, and actually the difficulty, is trying to determine the environmental input. Why is that tricky and more difficult? Because your genes are empirical and they don't change. They're the same when you're born and the same when you die, clearly. The environment is volatile, it changes all the way through life, and it's actually, in most cases, very, very difficult to measure, okay? So that's the trick. There is never, whenever we talk about genetics, and this is one of the things that has always chucked at me, you know, people think, oh, it's this immutable thing that you actually look at, which is true, purely from a genetics point of view, but genes do not exist in isolation. Genes exist within the environment that we're in, therefore changing the impact those genes have, therefore shifting therefore explaining how things can change while your genes don't change, and yet it having a role to play with genes. If you see what I'm saying. Now, if you do that maths, then actually the heritability of body weight is 70%. It certainly ain't zero. Okay, it's not 100% either. For some perspective, the heritability of height, which I think no one here would debate, has some genetic influence, okay, is 85%. So it's certainly not as high as height, but height is A, unidirectional, and B, non-volatile. Okay, you don't kind of randomly shrink through life. Whereas obesity, body weight, clearly there is some level of volatility and is not unidirectional once you reach your maximum body weight, but it's certainly approaching that of height. Now, the first molecular handle that we actually had that there was any kind of hormonal system that regulated body weight at all, okay, beyond moral fiber and willpower, okay, came from the identification of this brown tennis ball with whiskers and a tail, okay, which is roughly what they're about the size and shape of, okay, this mouse. And this mouse here, a not genetically modified, a naturally occurring mouse, has a mutation in a gene called leptin. Now, leptin, as it turns out, and you can see that because of that, there's more than twice the weight of its litter mates. Now, leptin, which I'm going to spend just a little bit of time going through the biological function of, is a hormone that's produced from fat, and it circulates in the blood in proportion to the amount of fat that has. Okay, so it's a marker for how much fat you have. It signals to the brain to let your brain know, amongst other pieces of information, how much fat you have. Now, why is this an important piece of information? It's important because how much fat you have is how long you would last in the wild without any food, okay? Not a problem today, of course. We now have too much food, but in the past, when we never had enough food, this would have been an important integer to actually hold in your head, okay? So, based on this, we now have a general idea, simplistic, but I think probably quite accurate, schema in which we kind of hang when we actually deal with how we are talking about food intake, and hence how we're also talking about body weight. Your brain needs to know two pieces of information in order to control your food intake. Okay, the first I've already told you, it needs to know how much fat you have. The second piece of information your brain needs to know is what you have just eaten and what you're currently eating, your short-term signals. Now, these signals are going to come from your gut, your gastrointestinal tract, okay? And they circulate in the blood as well. And what happens is your brain senses these long-term and short-term signals, integrates it, and then influences your next interaction with a menu, with a supermarket, or with your fridge, okay, in terms of your dinner. And there are genetic modifiers that run throughout the entire process, which you can then harness in order to try and understand the biology of the system. And this is what I want to talk to you guys about today. So it's and we now understand, for example, that this particular system called the leptin melanocortin pathway, in which leptin, I told you about from fat, signals to an area in the area in the brain called the hypothalamus. For those of you who don't know where that is, the bridge of your nose, right to the center of your brain, the base of your brain, just above the pituitary. That's where the hypothalamus sits. It's the sensing area of it. And there, a number of neurons called the POMC neurons are activated, producing a number of peptides that signal to the MC4 receptor, okay, in order to influence food intake. I will come back and give you a couple of examples. Just, I won't bore you guys silly, I hope, and give you just a couple of examples about this particular pathway. That's the first thing. The second thing about this I wanted to tell you about is that what I'm going to be talking about is not human specific. It's not even mammalian specific. Okay, these are strongly, strongly conserved pathways that are there, which have kept us alive throughout our entire process. So it's at this point that my current boss, our head of department, Stephen O'Rahilly, came on the scene. So this would have been in the late 90s. And he asked the question, if there could be a naturally occurring mutation within one mammalian species, the mouse, that actually causes severe obesity, can the same thing happen in humans? Is it more broadly applicable? It was entirely possible that this mouse thing could have been a weird mousy thing, okay? Because clearly mice are small, they're just different, clearly. But to cut a long story short, him and Steve and his time, his clinical fellow of his, Sadaf Faruqi, looked and they found the first two humans. These are two children of Pakistani descent, first cousins, with mutations in leptin, okay? So same gene as the mouse I showed you, different mutations. And so they lack a signal telling their brain how much fat they have. So what do they look like? You can see what they look like. How about their phenotype? Well, they're of normal birth weight, but they become hyperphagic after weaning. So hyper for more, phagic for eat. But it's a pathogenic term. You can't say, oh, I was hyperphagic last night. You ate too much, right? So hyperphagic in the sense where they have a pathological behavior around food. They have to have their freezer doors locked, quite literally have it locked, because they will go in and actually eat the frozen food within the freezer, the fish fingers and things like that, all right? Now, I'm going to come back, surprising, slightly ew to my sound, I'm going to come back and give you an example, a situation, for which that is not as unusual as you might seem. So just hold that thought in your head, and you can read the rest. No defect in energy expenditure, increased fat mass, that's a lot of fat, a normal height, but they don't undergo puberty, so they're infertile, okay, and they have an impaired immune system, which seems to be slightly odd to be talking about within an obesity perspective, but actually, it's these last two which begin to provide some really interesting insights about the role of leptin, okay? So this is a closer look at the child A, the younger boy. Just to point that out, okay, this is a three-year-old who weighs 42 kilograms, okay? Perspective-wise, so multiply by 2.2 for pounds, divided by 14 for stone, okay? So perspective-wise, I am 75 kilograms, and so this, we are looking at a three-year-old who's two-thirds of my body weight. This is not, I played too much PlayStation, drank too much Coca-Cola type of obesity. There's something wrong with the child. He has a mutation in leptin. Now, leptin is a hormone produced from fat, circulates in the blood. So once again, Steve O'Rahilly asked the question, well, can we replace it? So if you take type 1 diabetes as an analogy, where you lack insulin and so therefore have to inject yourself with insulin in order to manage your glucose homeostasis, can the child inject himself with leptin in order to manage his fat homeostasis? To cut another long story short, amazingly, he could, okay? So this is the same child, now 7 years old, weighing 32 kilograms. You wouldn't look, and it's two ways in the street because the child looks perfectly normal. The patent at the time for leptin, look at the date of publication, 1999, okay? So this is more than 20 years ago. So at the time, the patent was held by the Rockefeller University in New York because it was discovered by Jeffrey Friedman's lab, who was from the Rockefeller. But the patent was licensed to the American pharmaceutical giant Amgen. Now, to have been in the boardroom of Amgen when these results come in. I mean, they must have wet themselves. They must have thought that they have cured all everyone's Christmases that come in one go because they cured obesity. Except they hadn't, because we're now 21 years on. Leptin, for those of you who have heard of leptin, and maybe some of you have not, it's certainly not a panacea for obesity. And it's not like Amgen didn't try. Okay, so Amgen gave leptin to fat people, thin people, old people, young people, you know, boys, girls, males, females, people of all different colors. Here's the one truth that emerged, okay? If you had a functioning leptin system, this child does not have a functioning leptin system, but if you had a functioning leptin system, then it didn't matter whether or not you had the BMI of 18, like a supermodel, okay, or you looked like Santa Claus, okay? If you had a functioning leptin system, adding extra leptin through injecting did not make one iota of difference from the perspective of food intake, okay? The question is why, given that if you didn't have a leptin, a functioning leptin system, you were exquisitely sensitive to it. So leptin comes from the Greek word leptos, for thin. And when leptin was first discovered, all of us within the field were bamboozled, all of us, because we were thinking, hormone system, proportion to fat, circulates, and when there's too much leptin, when you give back leptin, they eat less. It's a negative feedback loop. It's there for your brain to say, oh, there's too much fat, we need to reduce the amount of fat. Except if you think just a little bit about it, because when in evolution, as I mentioned before, would we have had a situation where we had too much food that we actually needed to evolve an entire system to stop yourself from getting too fat? The answer is never, because this situation would not have been there. I'm going to be cutting lots of long story shorts, but at the end of the day, leptin does not function, as it turns out, when there's loads of it sloshing about, letting your brain know that you have too much fat. Leptin functions when it begins to disappear. Okay? Because what happens, when is the situation leptin begins to disappear? When you're running out of fat. Okay? And what leptin does is, as it begins to run out, it turns on in your brain the starvation response. That is its role. So what is the starvation response? Because that's what happens when you not have enough fat, you're starving. First of all, to eat, clearly. Now, all of us know, we go through this every day, that when we are very hungry, the simplest foods taste great. Rice, a little bit of bread, a little bit of cheese, whatever, delicious. But the fuller we become, the pickier we become with our food, okay? We go through this every single day of our lives. But imagine if you were actually starving. Plane crash in the Andes, your partner is looking delicious, starving, okay? Would you end up eating frozen food, including fish fingers, to keep yourself alive? Yes, you would. Okay, so as it turns out, all human beings, all mammals probably, become hyperphagic when they are actually starving, okay? Because you want to keep yourself alive. So in spite of this poor child's body habitus and the amount of fat he's carrying, because of a lack of that key signal letting your brain know, well, how much fat you have, that one piece of information, he has a brain who thinks he is starving, and so therefore this pathological feeding behavior. What else happens in starvation? Well, your brain has to begin to triage calories for itself. So why? Look, your brain is 2-3% of your body weight, but at rest, sat here, okay, at the moment, 2-3% of your body weight, it uses up 25% of the circulating glucose in your blood, okay? Why? It's metabolically hideously expensive, but it also does all the command and control, okay, which is why it's quite so expensive. So it begins to save calories for itself, so that even in your haze of hunger, you're able to put together some semi-cogent strategy to kind of track down food. Okay, so how does it do this? It begins to shut down metabolically expensive but immediately unimportant pathways. First of which is reproduction. Okay, so look, ladies, you know that time of the month. Loads of wasted calories. At the edge of starvation, those calories, which are washing away, are the difference between life and death. So your brain shuts the whole system off. And actually, if you were actually starving, the last thing you're going to want to do is to plop a baby out into the Serengeti, because how are you going to feed the baby? Because you're actually starving. So your brain just shuts off the whole system. And what else is expensive? Your immune system. Okay, your immune system is like a whole bunch of pilot lights, you know, waiting to be exposed to whatever, you know, antigen suddenly appears again in order to actually turn everything on. So your brain just tunes it down. Now, people might say, here, how about infection? Triage, guys. You're going to die of hunger before you die of an infection. And the whole thing, entirely reversible, okay? Because when you give back leptin, when leptin becomes replete again, suddenly, well, A, he shrunk, Okay, even somatically he has grown this way, but yet he shrunk, because his feeding behavior is normalized because of leptin. Reproduction, his older cousin, give the date here, 21 years ago, is now in her 30s, early 30s. Okay, she now has a young family. She's the first leptin deficient organism in all of evolution to carry a baby to term because of daily injections of leptin. Reproduction, fixed. Immune system, I haven't showed you the data, also fixed. That is leptin's role in order to try and keep yourself alive by turning on the starvation response. Okay, so that's leptin. Now what happens when it gets to the hypothalamus? I told you about the POMC neurons. Okay, now I can show you pictures of kids with mutations in POMC, and they look the same size as this child over here, except with bright red hair. I can show you the mouse models which we created, recapitulating that phenotype, but those were done relatively old. Okay, they were really quite old. Instead, I'll focus on some relatively recent stuff. I'll work on Labrador retrievers. I don't know, anybody here own Labradors? I don't know Labradors? No Labrador owners here, okay. But Labradors, retrievers, are the most popular pet dogs in the UK and in North America. Okay, in fact, in this country, we use them to sell toilet paper, as you know. So, and why? Because they're wonderful pet dog, family dogs, they have a wonderful temperament. But keep your compost bin shut, in fact, keep any cupboard shut, because it will eat anything, okay, until it almost pops. It is an immensely food-motivated animal. Now, this work was led by a veterinary surgeon colleague of mine. So she did her PhD in human genetics, but then went back to becoming a vet. And she was always, Eleanor Raffin, was always interested in why, about the genetics underlying this food motivation. Another long story, cut short. As it turns out, a percentage of Labradors have a deletion in the POMC gene. Okay, not all of them, but some of them do. And if you look at body weight with regards to their genes, these are dogs without, Labradors without the deletion, one copy, two copies. And you can see this increase in body weight. So each deletion is worth a couple of kilograms. So which means that if you have a homozygous, if the Labrador was homozygous for it, they'd be 4 kilos heavier. It doesn't sound like a lot until you begin to realize that Labradors only get to about 30 to 35 kilos. So this is a lot of dog, okay? Now if you then look at food motivation, you see exactly the same pattern of an increase in food motivation because of this deletion. So this is the numbers I just told you about, around 0.3 of a standard deviation of body weight per allele. So 20 to 25% of pet Labradors have this deletion. But interestingly, 95% of Labradors are heavily food motivated. So Eleanor, who's now a Wellcome Trust Fellow, is funded in order to throw the entire genetic book at this dog to try and find out, you know, what are the other genetic drivers actually modifying food intake in this particular animal. But this is not the end of the story, okay? Because so far, so not so interesting, because I already told you it's important in humans and important in mice. Why is it surprising that it's important in dogs, okay? Well, the other thing about Labradors, it turns out, that they are very, very trainable, okay? In fact, they're so trainable that they're primarily used, once again in North America and in the UK, as guide dogs for the blind, okay? Now, guide dogs are like the Navy SEALs of the dog world, okay? They've been trained within an inch of their life, because, well, they're about to be given a visually impaired human being to look after for the rest of their life. And that huge failure rate, okay, absolutely, the few, the proud, the guide dogs, okay, like huge failure rate, those who fail become pets. And what happens is the few that succeed then obviously then become this elite guide dogs. And they're trained using Pavlovian training techniques with food, okay? And so if we then look at our cohort of guide dogs within the pet course, 80% of the successful guide dogs have this deletion in POMC, making them more food motivated. So here's the concept, okay? Here's a guide dog, and here's visually impaired Mrs. Smith, okay? Now imagine if a chicken suddenly ran across the road. So what are the chances of a chicken dinner? I don't know, 50-50, 80-20. It doesn't matter. The guide dog is trained that it has a 100% chance of dinner, okay, if he brings Mrs. Smith home. So we start with looking at food motivation, okay, which is what I'm still interested in clearly, and suddenly found ourselves in the realm of trainability because of how the selection pressure has actually been made. So, you know, for those of you, you know, people think, oh, Fido loves me. Look at this, he doesn't love you, he's hungry. Yeah, anyway, so, no owners here though. And so we ended up, so this is Eleanor, who's leading the study, and that's one of the participants, Jasper, okay, a chocolate Labrador. So what happens with PoMC? PoMC then signals to the MC4 receptor. Okay, this is the receptor for PoMC products. And this is, I'm telling this story not chronologically, sort of Quentin Tarantino style. So this is where I appeared. This is 1998, my first postdoc. And we found that mutations in the melanocortin 4 receptor, MC4 receptor, results in severe obesity in humans. Okay? Shouldn't be surprising now that I've, hopefully not. But what is interesting is it turns out that the mutations in the MC4 receptor are the commonest monogenic single gene cause of obesity that we actually know. So at last count, and we're working the numbers up now, 1 in 400 of the general population will have demonstrably pathogenic mutations in the MC4 receptor, all right? So either in heterozygous or in homozygous form. That makes it more common than cystic fibrosis and Prader-Willi syndrome put together, okay, for that. We're looking at 200,000 people in this country itself, 2.5 million people in the world will have mutations in the MC4 receptor. With so many receptors around, okay, mutations around, pardon me, you'd be unsurprised to know that some of the mutations are going to be particularly severe and so going to end up in a fully dead receptor, okay, dead. Some of them are going to be more subtle, okay, single nucleotide changes here and there, and they'll have a partially functional receptor, anywhere from say 30 to 70% function. So this work was done by me over there in the early 2000s when I was a postdoc. The work down here was done by my colleague, Sadaf Faruqi, in a clinical research facility on human beings, okay, of which this is a completely different building. I didn't see the human beings. And so she measured food intake in a buffet scenario in children. It's very difficult to do this in adults, okay, in children. And what you can see is this is leptin deficiency, those kids I was showing you, and this is treated leptin deficiency. You see this huge drop-off in food intake. And sandwiched in between there are the MC4R deficient human beings. Now, she just analyzed the kids as they came through, right? She only distributed them into these different graphs when I supplied experimental data from tissue culture, recombinant protein, okay, within a test tube scenario. And we could predict how much a child was going to eat based on the level of function of the receptor within a test tube in another building, me never having seen the patient. So what we began to realize was that the MC4 receptor is not binary. It's not you have it or you don't. It's a rheostat. It's a tunable system, okay, where not only in the number of copies, the quality of the receptor on the surface was actually important. And now you begin to look closer, you begin to realize this is not human specific, it's not dog specific. It's present there in agriculture. So these are, I was, In the early 2000s, I was giving a talk, and this lady came up to me after, and she was representing a pig breeding company. Pig breeding, not pig engineering company, in which they were trying to make pigs for bacon and blah, blah, blah. Okay. And as it turns out, some of their pigs that produced the best bacon because of their rate of growth, da, 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 had mutations in the MC4 receptor. And this is going to be true for other agricultural animals as well. Naturally occurring mutations in which you're just selecting for a given trait, not for the mutation, resulting in an enrichment of specific mutations. Not only in mammals, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know if you guys heard of the blind Mexican cavefish. So they're not only fish, they're blind. They're not only blind, they're Mexican. Okay, so these are boring fish with eyes, so yesterday, okay? And these are blind fish. Now, this is around the area where that asteroid that hit and killed the dinosaurs occurred. And what happens is there are a whole series of caves around there. Okay. Now, here, some fish got stuck in there, and there they lived. Because it's in a cave underwater, there's no light, so the eyes evolved away, okay? So they're blind. But what's interesting is they ate a lot of food in a dark cave, and so whenever any food comes in, because a tide sloshed them in or something like that, they have to make sure they track the food down. As it turns out, all of the blind Mexican cavefish that are still alive today all have mutations in the MC4 receptor. Why? Because those are the only ones that were driven enough to find the food whenever there was food. You know, the fish that were going, dead ex-fish, okay, no longer fish. You know, whereas the ones that were there, even in blind Mexican cavefish. If you just think I'm talking about vertebrates, no. So I have a fly arm. I don't actually have a fly arm. Can we make fruit flies fat? Turns out we can, okay? So we have an assay, so Drosophila, these are the ones that appear when your bananas go brown, not blue bottles, they don't fly around poo, okay? So we have something called a CAFE assay, okay? And a CAFE, for what flies like to eat is a mixture of yeast and glucose. This is their food, okay? So you can put a capillary in, okay, and have a yeasty glucose mixture. And if you dot a little bit of food dye at the top and as a meniscus, at the top of the meniscus, you can actually track in millimeters how much food is being eaten over time, okay? You can't do it with just one fly, they're very small, dead fly, but you put 10, 20 flies in and you can track the rate of eating of a fly. What happens is if we fast the fly just overnight, they eat faster, not surprisingly. If we put a fly on a high fat diet, okay, they then eat less. Okay, once again, they go, oh, dude, I'm full, right? And even in flies. And we have a number of other assays, which I won't bore you with, okay? I will bore you with the green stomach assay because I think this is just so cool from a nerdy perspective. First of all, flies have translucent tummies, okay? That's the first interesting thing. So what happens is if you put a fly normally, okay, then fast them overnight, and then give them food for 20 minutes, this is the assay, normal food, and then switch them to food that's been dyed green. Okay, so what has happened is, in theory, they should eat a lot during the first 20 minutes, and if they're really, really still hungry, they'll continue eating and they'll end up with a green tummy. All right, and so you see that this is what happens on a normal diet. But what happens if you overfeed them? If you put them on a high fat diet, then you have a lot less flies with green tummies because they're already full. Okay, and so no flies. Anyway, this is, I won't bore you. And there's mass, that's boring, glucose, and climbing and climbing assay. And my point is, while the flies do not have a melanocortin system per se, they have genes which act upstream of the pathway, modifying the pathway within mammals, but yet when we mutate that gene, they eat more within the actual settings, even in flies. And here's my point. These are flies. These are blind Mexican cavefish, okay? Where is the morality? Okay, where is the choice within this particular scenario? These are hardwired behaviors in response to physiological perturbations or pathophysiological perturbations, depending on what you want to talk about. So this is probably the last maybe 10 minutes. What I've talked about till now, is monogenic, single gene defects, okay, within the melanocortin pathway largely, that I was telling you about, causing severe phenotypes. But the vast majority, okay, I say 1 in 400 of the population, but what happens to the other people, okay? Okay, we don't have single gene defects per se making us different in our body weight. For the rest of us, our body weight is going to be a function of polygenes, many genes each having a very subtle function. So we now have a good idea about the genetic architecture underlying common obesity. So this Jackson Pollock diagram, you don't have to read all of the individual genes that are here. Just two messages I wanted you to take away from here. Okay, the first is that there are probably two big groupings of genes to do with our body shape and size. So the pink group up there and a big blue blob over here, all right? Now, as it turns out, those pink genes up there have to do with what we call our waist to hip ratio. So the circumference of your waist over the circumference of your hip. And if you take the ratio, you realize that, well, that actually indicates your body shape. Do I have a big bum versus a small tummy, big tummy versus a small bum? Do I look like a sausage, okay? And for that, it's where you put your fat. So the pink genes, where do you put your fat? Your body shape. The blue genes down here have to do with your BMI, regardless of where you put your fat. So this is, put simplistically, how much fat you have. Message number one, where you put your fat, at least genetically, has absolutely nothing to do with how much fat you have. So where you put your fat, those genes, as it turns out, have to do with fat biology. Okay, so they're just fundamentally cell biology. Whereas how much fat you have to do with genes within the central nervous system in the brain, okay, and where we know their function influences feeding behavior. So this is another a way of looking at the data. This is called a Manhattan plot. And it's a Manhattan plot because it looks like the skyline of Manhattan. Now this gene, FTO, I've spent 13 years of my life, ladies and gentlemen, 1/3, okay, of my life on studying this gene. You realize this is the first time I've mentioned it? Because it's a very sad story, and I don't want to share that with you. Except to point out that it is not a mutation. I just want to stress, these are now no longer mutations. There's very subtle variations. Half of you in this room, for example, will have the variants in FTO that make you, on average, 1.5 kilos heavier, and 20 to 25% more likely to be overweight over a lifetime. Okay? If you carry two copies, of which is 1/6 of you, 1 billion people in the world, okay, will be on average 3 kilos heavier and have an increased risk of becoming obese over a lifetime of 50%, okay? So these are not mutations. And all of you will have some mix of these genes here, which then reflect where you sit on the normal distribution of body weight. So what are some of these genes? I've just highlighted two. That, for those of you who can see at the back, is POMC of Labrador fame, okay? That is the MC4 receptor of pigs and blind Mexican cavefish fame. And so what you can see here is that the leptin-melanocortin pathway emerges. Severe mutations, as I talked to you about, result in severe obesity, whereas very, very subtle changes in exactly the same pathway influence where we sit on the normal distribution of body weight. Okay, the same pathways are involved when they're actually there. Okay, which leads to this question. You can now create the buzz term out there, polygenic risk scores, which means that you can take all of these genes and add up how many risk factors you have for becoming heavier versus lighter and create a risk score. Okay? And so you can now plot the risk score. And what happens is if you actually plot the number of risk variants you have versus your BMI, you see a linear relationship. So the more of these you have, the more likely you are to be heavy. Which begs the question, can we find folks, remember this is empirical, before they even start growing, babies, okay, and ask, ooh, this person is more likely to become obese. We should intervene. We should do something about it, okay, genomically or something. And I've been asked this many times, and many companies do it. This is 23andMe, all right? So other companies exist. Don't waste your money. Look, I live in a tiny village just about 10 miles outside Cambridge. We have two windmills, one of which is broken. We have two churches, one of which is deconsecrated, okay? And we have a pub. I can't even buy bread in my village. But somebody felt the need to knock on my door to try and sell me a genetic test. And now these tests, okay, can make all kinds of random predictions. You can imagine intelligence, et cetera, and your body weight, okay? And here's the problem. This is true for all genetic companies, not just 23andMe. Fundamentally misunderstand the difference between population level risk and individual prediction. Do I have the example here? No, I don't. Okay. So population level risk is finding an effect once you study 50,000, 100,000, millions of people and finding the average versus what happens to any given person, okay, with that particular variation. And what you'll find is for the FTO, for example, here, half of you here will have it, a sixth of you here, but you know, we're not hugely different in body weight because we are roughly the same economic class. We, you know, what do we do? How young? How old? What do we actually do? All this then influence what happens with your genes that are there. So don't at the moment. They are misinterpreting the data, trying to force it to do something which it doesn't do. So a couple of final thoughts. First question I ask, you know, am I giving anyone an excuse? Okay, and I'm not. So I think you can consider your genes, your genetic architecture, like a hand of poker, okay, for lack of a better analogy. You can have good hands, you can have bad hands, and the only people you can blame are your folks, and they gave them to you, all right, in terms of that. But you can win with a bad hand of poker, okay, depending on how you play it, even though it's more difficult. I'll give you another example. I will never, ever run as fast as Usain Bolt, okay? It's down to my genes, that's my excuse. But it doesn't mean that if I train, I won't run faster than I actually do now. Look, there is a misunderstanding amongst the general public that your genes, because they are heritable, they do give you traits, are a single point in space and time, which is not true. What your genes do is they bracket a range of possibilities. They still give you a range of possibilities, just not, look, why am I bald? My genes. Why do I look Chinese? My genes, okay, for that. And that ain't gonna change it. But it brackets a sense of possibilities where within that bracket, you can then try and, depending on what you do with your life, depending on your socioeconomic class, depending on any number of different things, you can move up and down within that particular range. I'm not giving anyone any excuse whatsoever. I'll deal with one final point and then I will wrap up. The dessert tummy is relevant, okay? So let's review what the dessert tummy is. You go to a meal, like to a proper restaurant, not weird Michelin small plate food, okay? Like proper food. Now imagine, what I guarantee you almost, that once you get to the middle of your main meal, to the end of the main meal, you would have achieved pretty much your metabolic requirements for the day, meaning that you have recouped pretty much all of the calories you burnt that day, okay? But yet, when the chocolate cake arrives, you eat the chocolate cake. That is the dessert tummy. The interesting question to ask is, why is it specific for desserts? Okay, so Imagine you've gone out and you've had steak and chips for a meal. And you got full, and so you stopped. But say this was an all-you-can-eat place. And then the waiter comes by, more steak, more chips, more steak, more chips. And you say, no, man, I feel like puking, no, thank you. But yet, you eat the chocolate cake. Why won't you eat more steak and chips, but why will you eat chocolate cake? Right. So there is an like with all these things, there's an evolutionary reason for it. 50,000 years ago, Serengeti. This is an antelope. Okay, so now imagine it's cost me 2,000 calories to take down the antelope. What happens when I get back to the village? I have to eat at least 2,000 calories, okay? Because obviously at some point, then I die. But if I only eat 2,000 calories, that's no good either, because there's no guarantee I'll get the antelope the next time round. So a part of your brain called the hedonic region, the part that makes eating taste nice, the ooh feeling of food, which happens to chocolate cake and not broccoli, okay, takes over. So I eat more than I need. But here's the important point. How do you get past the mechanical difficulty of being stuffed with full of 2,000 calories worth of venison? Okay? Well, your brain begins to change the type of calories it craves for. Not the type of calories, the caloric density of the food it craves for. Which means that for every given gram, you get more calories. Why? So you can continue stuffing calories into you once you're even full. All right? What is high in caloric density? 50,000 years ago, it would have been stuff that was high in free sugars, maybe fruit, maybe ripe fruit, maybe some honey, and food that is high in fat. Okay? What is high in sugar and fat? Desserts. So the dessert tummy is a holdover from your time in the Serengeti where you could continue eating even though you were already stuffed to the gunnels to keep yourself alive. And in keeping with the theme of conservation of pathways, lest you think that dessert tummy has to be a weird human phenomenon. Surely. Mm-mm. So consider the grizzly bear. No, okay, stop. Clearly a grizzly bear is not there with a muscat and a tartar citron going, ooh, delicious. No, okay? But grizzly bear, Pacific Northwest, okay? Hitting the salmon run to prepare for hibernation. Okay, so its whole goal is to eat as much salmon as possible to survive hibernation. Now, when they begin the salmon run, they eat the whole salmon. Yeah, tuk, 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 the whole salmon's gone. But as they get fuller and fuller and fatter, they only eat the skin and the fat under the skin of the salmon, leaving pretty much the entire salmon there. Okay, why? Because that is calorically the most dense part of the fish. So the phenomenon, like not called a dessert tummy, but the phenomenon of increasing the caloric density of the food that you crave as you get fuller is conserved. Okay, where is the choice? Where is the moral fiber that's actually been involved? So, are we all sinners? This is my closing couple of thoughts, okay? Look, when we talk about sin, okay, we talk about choice, pretty much, okay? This is where you're sinning because, unless you're Catholic, then you're born sinful. But let's leave the Catholics aside, okay, of which I am one, okay? But you make a choice, okay, in order to do that. This is me choosing to eat a pizza. So, but I guess here's my point, okay? I don't think body weight's a choice. And you might be thinking, I'm choosing to eat the pizza. So remember, our body weight as we stand today, as we look, is we don't gain weight or lose weight overnight, sadly, okay, but we don't. Our body weight is a function of thousands of different food choices, each binary, yes, over the past few years, okay? But imagine if because of your biology, because of your hand of cards, you find it more difficult to say no. Not 10 times more difficult, 2, 3, 4% more difficult to say no at every single binary point. Over thousands of different decisions, okay, suddenly you find yourself eating more over a lifetime than someone else, making someone larger or smaller or average size, okay? Your body weight is not a choice, okay? And this is me choosing to eat the broccoli. So I think in the context of trying to solve the problem today, okay, couple of things. I draw a huge distinction between pointing out the problem, which obesity, metabolic diseases, diet-related illnesses are. I'm not shying away from that because it's true, okay? And blaming the person or persons suffering from the problem, okay? So look, there is physics. We've got to get people to eat less somehow, and this could be tackling the environment. This could be doing any number of different things, okay, that we're talking about. But blaming the person suffering from the problem, personal responsibility, which is where the policymakers seem to be pushing, is not going to help. Shouting at someone, blaming them, you know, is, to my view, not going to help. Until we understand that whatever we do that some people will always find it more difficult to say no until we accept this, until we accept that body weight is not a moral failing. Obese people, people with obesity are not bad, but they're fighting their biology. We're never, ever going to fix the problem. So I want to thank my colleagues, my senior colleagues, the guys who did the work. I'm at the MRC Metabolic Diseases Unit. I'm funded also by the BBSRC. I'm at the University of Cambridge. Anybody who's interested in my musings can follow me on Twitter. You've been a pleasure to speak to you. My name is Giles Hill. Thank you.